They say a pyramid will appear in the English countryside. People will forgo soap, endure sunburn, and eat only noodles. They will dance all night in crowds a thousand strong. And they'll call it festival season. Prepare for a great summer of music with the Guardian Festivals Guide. Packed with listings for all this year's events, plus Q&As and tips from festival veterans, from Guy Garvey to the mighty Iggy Pop. Don't miss your copy free with The Guardian this Saturday, as part of the Guardian and Observer music season, because music loves summer.
The Guardian.
Hello, I'm John Harris, and this is a special Music Weekly celebrating Bob Dylan's 70th birthday. In this programme, I'll be joined by Emmy the Great and The Guardian's Stephen Moss, and we'll each be choosing our favourite Dylan track. We'll hear what Dylan's cultural impact has been over the last 50 years, and we'll have a reading from a new audiobook version of the Bob Dylan Encyclopedia.
In Japan in 1986, Dylan reportedly said this: "Somebody comes to see you for 2 hours or 1.5 hours, whatever it is. I mean, they've come to see you. You could be doing anything up on that stage. You could be frying an egg or hammering a nail into a piece of wood. How infinitely more magical it would be if he did come on stage and proceed to fry an egg. All that Chaplin-esque panache, the comic possibilities."
That's all in this week's Music Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome to the podcast this week. I'm in the hot seat as Alexis Petridis is busy boxing up his entire music collection in preparation for a home move, and Rosie Swash is busy learning something hugely important on some kind of training course. Tuesday, May the 24th, is Bob Dylan's 70th birthday, and we're marking that this week with a whole programme about the great man. Joining me in the studio are The Guardian's Stephen Moss and another Moss, who you might know better, by the name of Emmy the Great, Emma Lee Moss. Welcome to both of you.
Hi.
Thanks very much.
We'll be speaking about Dylan's cultural impact later at length, but we should start with some of his music. We've each chosen our favourite track. We'll each explain why we've chosen what we've chosen. We'll begin with Emmy's choice. This is Tangled Up in Blue.
I had a job in the Great North Woods, working as a cook for a spell. But I never did like it all that much, and one day the axe just fell. So I drifted down to New Orleans, where I lucky with a be employed. Working for a while on a fishing boat right outside of Delacroix. But all the while I was alone. Seen a lot of women, but she never escaped my mind, and I just grew tangled up in blue.
Bob Dylan's Tangled Up in Blue from Blood on the Tracks, a favourite of Emmy the Great. Emmy, why is that? I don't know whether it's your favourite. It's hard to have one favourite Bob Dylan song, but why did you pick that one?
It's not actually even my favourite on that record, but it is the most personal to me. Just because when I first really got and became aware of Bob Dylan when I was at school, because I was desperate to get in with this older crowd of kids who played guitar. And like, rumour had it that they met up on a canal boat on the weekends and listened to Bob Dylan together. And when I left school, I actually managed to get in with them. And I used to go with them to the canal boat, and we would only sing the one song, Tangled Up in Blue, because that was the only one that Barney, whose boat it was, knew on the piano. And now I see them very rarely, but every time we see each other, we sing Tangled Up in Blue together. And just like hearing it makes me want to cry and drink a vat of cider.
How old were you then when sort of Bob Dylan came on your radar?
Well, my dad wasn't. I don't know why I assume it would be my dad. No, my parents weren't really the Dylan type of music fans, so I was probably about 16, 17 at school. And I didn't really fully understand it until I think I was in university, and I heard another song from Blood on the Tracks, which was You're a Big Girl Now.
Is that your favourite?
That is probably my favourite Dylan song, fully, just because I was on my own listening to this music quite softly, and he has this howl, this very long note before the chorus comes in, and I just put my thing down that I was doing and thought, this is fantastic, I really get it now. It wasn't just a social thing anymore, it was like a musical thing.
Stephen, Blood on the Tracks, within Dylan's pantheon, what do you reckon?
Well,
his great moment of sort of artistic revival after a pretty dry spell, it is said.
Possibly the greatest album.
Really?
In many respects, yeah. I think it's, aficionados would say it could be his greatest album. Certainly it's the it marks the period where I think the decline sets in after this. so he has this sort of fantastic period in the 60s. There's then some iffy albums in the early 70s, not helped by the fact he changes label and Columbia bring out a very strange album almost to sabotage his move to Asylum.
Simply called Dylan.
Yeah, which actually is better than it's cracked up to be. I just bought a copy recently.
And it's cracked up to be a load of rubbish.
It is, but it's actually not bad. It's not bad. It's quite hard to get now because it was when he went back to Columbia, it was deleted. But it's you can get it. I bought a copy recently at sort of huge expense, and it's better than it's thought.
And you
to be.
Really think Blood on the Tracks could be his best album?
I think so. The most integrated, certainly.
So we're out then. You see of the period of Dylan, which is truly iconic and almost beyond question in the popular understanding, is the mid-60s period, right? Bringing It All Back Home, Highway 61, Blonde on Blonde, those three. And yet you're saying Blood on the Tracks has the edge.
Well, I think that those three are unquestionably great. I think we don't question early Dylan. I mean, there's just this 10-year period of incredible productivity. I think Blood on the Tracks is in some ways more personal. He's making public statements in the early 60s, then he becomes a little more personal. And this album, you know, he's just having a very difficult relationship with his, you know, he's just breaking up with his wife, and he starts painting. He gets into painting, and he gets almost a guru who kind of tells
him... Norman Rayburn.
Exactly, yeah. And it's not quite clear to me what he brought, but it's always... Dylan always said that, that didn't help the relationship with Sarah because she didn't anymore understand where he was coming from. But also these songs are very different to anything he's come up with before. And I think written from kind of multiple perspectives, because I don't read Tangled Up in Blue as one story. Do you read it as
one
story?
That's a good question.
That's the thing I always think about. The story doesn't make sense. Yeah. I actually go back to think about this a lot because it's interesting when you're trying to write a narrative song to see what he does there. It doesn't add up. You don't know if the woman is the same woman in the first verse and the last verse.
I'm sure it's not. I'm sure these are different.
And there are versions where some of the pronouns get switched around as well. So it's early one morning, the summer's hand, and he was laying in bed. So I don't think even he had it straight in his own mind, you know.
Yeah, it's probably one of those songs that he wrote verses and verses and verses for, and then
I think what confuses people about Blood on the Tracks is they think it's just about Sarah. That's obviously in there, but there are kind of... I think he's coming... That's a starting point, but he's laying sort of layers of musical paint on top of it.
I think that's what people assume personal records are always directly about the experience, but it is just a starting point, the situation or the relationship, and everything else is fictionalized. That's why people do it, because you can explore your life in an imaginative way.
You must have that problem all the time as a songwriter, because every songwriter who sings about love, loss, life and death always does, which is that people collar you and say, oh, this is about you. That's always the assumption.
I think that's a problem for my boyfriends. I always make a point of telling people that it's just a starting point and everything else is me romanticising or making a big deal out of it.
This is a breakup record. Have you made a breakup record or written breakup songs in any volume?
I mean, my first one was like a contrived breakup record, and my second one was attempting not to...
Does that mean you contrived the breakup for the record or contrived the record after the breakup?
Probably a bit of both.
Wow.
What irritates me about... Sorry, just to go back to the lyrics. But what irritates me about Tangle is the penultimate verse, which I think is so... I mean,
can you remind us what the penultimate verse is?
I lived with them on Montague Street in a basement down the stairs. There was music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air. And then he started dealing with slaves and something inside of him died.
I think that's a reference to Arthur Rimbaud.
Well, people have said that.
Yeah.
Arthur Rimbaud, the French poet, became briefly a slave trader, didn't he?
It's possible. I have seen that argued.
Yeah, I always think about that, like when you watch a David Lynch film and you're trying desperately to get a plot out of it. I always think with this song, he tricks you into thinking there is a plot, but actually you feel like you're in the 60s, and then all of a sudden, well, there are no slave dealers in the 60s, hopefully, that we know of. And so it's actually just a mood piece.
Other people like it could be a general reference to prostitution, that the slaves are prostitutes.
This is analysing Dylan in the manner that in Life of Brian that they analysed the Sermon from the Mount. It's a blessed are the cheesemakers moment.
And I'm not always sure it's worth it because I think Dylan necessarily always in control of his material.
I
think somebody who's written Tarantula, you have to say, is not necessarily always in control of his material.
But the other thing is, I wonder, I'll ask Emmy first and then ask you this, Stephen, is are we missing the point somewhat? I mean, all Dylan fans get lost in sort of treating some of his lyrics like text, you know, when you're doing your O-level English and you're taking everything apart, as you say, saying, when's this set and so on, which we don't do with any other rock lyricist, really. In the end, it's about what it makes you feel like. I mean, do you ever wonder whether we're doing him a disservice being this forensic about him?
I mean, I think that was one of the things that he found very annoying sort of in the mid-60s, wasn't it? That people tried to pin him down too much and they wanted him to be too literal. I think probably all artists do that. Probably all artists are contrary. If you tell them what you think their piece of work is about, then they'll tell you it's something completely different. And the meaning for them probably changes, I assume. Who knows? Maybe he knows.
Stephen, are you prone to analysing Dylan's words in the manner that other people analyse poetry?
But I do think he's worth it. I do think he's, you know, he takes himself serious as an artist, and I think we should take him serious as an artist. And it's one reason why he's lasted 50 years.
On that note, we will move on to my choice. This is the electric version of Shelter from the Storm, originally on Blood on the Tracks, from the live album Hard Rain. I was burned out from exhaustion. Well, in the course of the next bit of conversation, I might explain why I chose that version. But Emmy, what do you think of that version of Shelter from the Storm?
Actually, can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Dylan live?
Many times.
When would you say was the last time where it was like the true Dylan experience?
It's always the true Dylan experience.
When was the last time you saw him?
I don't know, around about, I get lost, 2005, something like that, probably.
And do you feel like it's a different type of experience, though, from when you first saw him?
Yeah. I mean, his persona on stage and the way that he sings and so on. I mean, his voice has changed, but for now, he's shot to bits now. In a way, it was moving towards that through the whole of the 90s, really. But it really is now. But what he's like now with the kind of cowboy threads and so on, and it's a bit more acoustic-y than it was the first time I saw him. The first time I saw him, it was in 1995, possibly. And he came on at the Brixton Academy and he wasn't even playing the guitar. He had a harmonica holder and he was dancing like the young Elvis, if you can imagine that, waggling his legs. And I think if you read some of the biographies, they say that he'd had a few beers and it was very sort of rambunctious, like a big gang of sailors had jumped on the stage. And it's not like that now. It's a bit more restrained. So it changes. But if you look at the film of Fort Collins in Colorado, which is the gig that's taken from, I mean, relative to what he's now, you think it was a different artist.
Because a lot of people, I mean, you get a lot of people on the internet moaning about how he plays now and how it's very insular and his voice is different and stuff. But I wonder if people are sometimes, like in that way that they feel like they owned his meanings, are they a bit too precious about his shows? They want something, they want it to always be the classic era.
I'm gonna defer to Stephen.
No,
you haven't. Okay, because I mean, in large part now I think the concerts are almost ritual occasions, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
I mean, some people go, I probably went to the same Brixton Academy, was it in 2005?
Rings
and I met people there who were going every night.
Yeah.
I think I might even try to review it for the guy, and I tried to give it 7 stars, which they rejected. But I met somebody beforehand that people wear cowboy hats, and they go every night to compare. I'm not this obsessive, I should say. I'm in the middle, I would say, in Dylanology. I met a guy who was coming up from, but taking the week off work, was coming up from Brighton or Bournemouth every night. And I was scribbling notes. And this guy standing next to me said, we're on a voyage with Bob. He said, write that down.
Oh, I love
and
that.
And I did, because I thought that was true. And if you've been, I first saw him in 1978, when he played at Earl's Court.
Yeah,
when he hadn't played in the UK since 69. So, and I was like 20, I just finished university, and it was a really important kind of rite of passage for me. And I was kind of hooked from that point on. And even through the kind of dark days, you might say, of the mid-80s, when the stuff was a little bit iffy and hard to get a hold of. So, I don't know, it's just been a sort of thread running through. And for sort of, you know...
Before we talk briefly about the track in question, which we're rather forgetting...
Why did you choose the live version?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, because the acoustic version on Blood on the Tracks is great. But on Hard Rain, things happen to the Blood on the Tracks material. It gets much fiercer. It's full of this sort of vengeful spirit. And the reason for that, according to the books, which I'll cite again, is that him and the Rolling Thunder Band, or what remained of it, were staying up in a house prior to this gig, and they were all getting drunk a lot. And I think there were certain paid women around and things, you know, doing what a certain sort of male rock band will do. And then they went to play this gig at this football stadium or similar, and it was raining really hard, and they were all getting electric shocks. And then Dylan, who'd been, you know, living a somewhat decadent lifestyle up to that point, his wife then turned up, with whom they were most of the waiters separating, with the kids, apparently, and stood in the wings at this gig, glaring at him, right? And the fact that he's just, his marriage is failing, he's getting electric shocks, it's peeing down with rain, and he just blasts out this stuff. And the reason I found Shelter from the Storm, that version, very interesting, among other reasons, is it sounds like The Clash. It sounds like sort of electric punk rock reggae. And The Clash was sort of doing that at the same time in London, but he can't have known. And yet he's sort of channeling all this stuff. And also he plays lead guitar on that. This really weird, clumsy bottleneck guitar. And it should be on YouTube, the Hard Rain gig. And it's just great. It's someone right at the end of their tether sort of shouting into the void. And given that people, you know, commonly think of Dylan as an acoustic balladeer, it's quite nice to see him when he's being unhinged and bonkers.
I think he's raging. Even his, you know, acoustic stuff, the sentiment is punk rock enough without needing to sound it.
And also the other point, I suppose, is there aren't any other artists that I can think of when there seem to be infinite incarnations, when you can go, well, that's him in Fort Collins, Colorado in 1976. And the year before that, he was completely different. And then Desire comes out a matter of months after that and sounds completely different. And about 18 months later, he gets Born Again Christianity and something else happens.
Is that,
you know,
New Morning? Is that a bit mixed up?
New Morning's his Domestic Bliss record, isn't
it? Oh. What's his Born Again record?
Slow Train Coming is the first one.
So I just got New Morning because of the name.
It's a good record, New Morning.
But this is also a Christian song, isn't it? I mean, there's,
yeah, it's very biblical. You know,
Christianity runs through this song. And is it not odd to have your punk version of this song when it's essentially about finding shelter from the storm?
But his wife's apparently glaring at him in the wings. So it's as if he's saying, "And what did that count for?" It's, you know.
Also, I think isn't there a story that he did that concert to video and it didn't work out. He wasn't happy with it, so he paid for this concert himself. They did it again.
Again, that rings a bell.
In bad weather, in front of not a very big audience. And so they just...
No, it's a very thin, sparse crowd, and they've all got umbrellas up. And for some reason, the whole band are wearing Arab headdresses, and they're effectively shouting at each other for about an hour. It's quite amazing. Anyway, so if you don't...
And great lyrics. I think this is... And you were saying earlier, should we analyse the lyrics? I think this almost works as a piece of poetry. If you read this through without... singing it.
Hunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn.
It's very interesting.
It's a lovely line. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form, and all of that.
Because often his lyrics don't work without the song, but here I think the lyrics, you know, almost work independently. Work independently.
That's fine. Actually, he didn't write the next song. But anyway, we'll come on to that. Now, the final track in this section is Stephen's choice. I thought I was trying to really underline my Dylan cred by picking something from Hard Rain, but I have been roundly beaten. This is a track called Moonshiner, which is from Volume 1 of the Bootleg series.
For 17 long years I spent all my money on whiskey and beer, I go to some hollow and sit at my still.
That was Moonshiner, an outtake from The Times They Are A-Changing. It was on Volume 1 of the Bootleg series. Stephen, why have you sailed out to the outer limits of... Not quite, really, of Bobscurity, if we can use that word.
Was it an outtake? I'm not sure it was ever scheduled to go on that album. Anyway, it was done...
it is 63.
Yeah, 63, but I think it's not quite clear why he recorded it. It was done as a demo for at the Witmark. It's a traditional song. Americans and the Irish argue over whether it's an Irish song or an American song. And why I like this, for several reasons. It's incredibly simple. The lyrics are simple, but I think he makes it into a really... He sings it brilliantly, so it proves that he's a great singer, you know, regardless of what everyone says about him. You know, amazing breath control, I think people normally talk about.
He says that in Don't Look Back, the film.
Yeah, and he's I think he's, 23 or 24 when he records this, and yet, you know, it's sung with immense emotion. A moonshiner is somebody who has an illegal distillery. It's also a sort of somebody who's drinking themselves to death. Basically, it's the original lyrics make it more obvious that it's just somebody who doesn't give a damn. He's drinking himself to death, an outlaw, a vagabond. And this 23-year-old, you know, knows all the American ballads and ballad singers, blues singers. He's absorbed everything. And at 23, he's already able to sing almost a lifetime of experience,
yeah.
Which is, I think is an incredible achievement. And the other reason I like this is that his career had a dip in the 80s, but one was sort of playing along and trying to like the albums he produced. You know, some Dylan fans do try and get every bootleg. I didn't bother with that. But once the official bootlegs came out, this first three-volume bootleg made you completely look afresh at the career. And I just fell in love with Dylan all over again. And he's never been a great chooser, I think, of what to put on his albums.
Terrible.
So what was odd about, and I think we're now up to, what, 9 volumes of bootlegs? They're just brilliant, and they make you think again about... I mean, my favourite version of Idiot Wind is not the one on Blood on the Tracks, but it's on the bootleg.
When you can, the one where you can hear his coat buttons rapping against the guitar. Yeah. Listen, I must stop you in these in rampant enthusiasm, because I'll run out of time, and I haven't asked Emmy what she thinks of Moonshiner. And actually, that period of Dylan's career, the early period, because it's often overlooked.
Is it? Because when you meet sort of like your first Dylan fans, they'll always reference those sort of folk protest songs from the 60s. And I always thought when I was first getting into Bob Dylan, why don't I like this? I think you said earlier it's a little bit formal, maybe. But this doesn't sound like that to me. This sounds really natural. He does melancholy really, really well. You know, when you catch him in a reflective song and his voice is again howling...
And it's true that, as Stephen said, he sounds old.
He's
23. His dad ran a little fridge shop in Duluth, Minnesota. You know, I mean, he's sort of lived on the road, but not like it. And yet, it's completely believable that performance.
I was so much older than I'm younger than that now.
Yeah,
he's younger than I was. But he was 23.
That for some reason does evoke a hobo sitting by the road.
It's a really brilliant performance, and it's so simple. I just noticed that he's dropped the chorus, so he's pared it right down. And he makes these three verses last 5 minutes. I think we probably didn't hear it, but there's a harmonica bit that lasts about 30 seconds. And it's just amazing the way he's made this incredibly simple song into quite an extended, beautiful kind of lament for kind of life.
And that was the word.
The whole world's a bottle.
Well, lament.
Yeah.
But the whole world's a bottle and life's but a dram. When the bottle gets empty, it sure ain't worth a damn. I there were so many Dylan songs I wanted to choose. I chose this would be the one I'd have at my funeral. That was my kind of thinking.
Would you have died from too much moonshine?
Possibly.
I've been to a funeral where they used, I think that's on the bootleg series as well, He Was a Friend of Mine.
Mm-hmm.
As the music when the coffin went into the flames, and it just killed you again, because that there's not much rock music can feel completely true to a moment like that, and Dylan just did it.
The thing about that song is when he was chronicling American life in the 60s, it really feels like a historical document, and I really feel from that song that I can see those people, bootleggers, man on the road, just...
And what's so incredible is that, of course, he then moved away from that. You know, even though the moment was still carrying on, the whole civil rights moment, he could easily have carried on with the folk protest. He was absolutely the centre of that, and he just rejected that. And, enormously, that famous New York Folk Festival when they, allegedly Pete Seeger tried to kind of break the wire so he couldn't play electric.
But is that true? Because I've seen, there's quite a lot of different versions of that now. They call it, a myth. And
it may be a myth, but certainly he got a lot of abuse. And the whole point is he's never really... cared about the abuse. He's just carried on doing his own thing.
Okay, well, similarly, you mentioned before, embracing born-again Christianity. Can you imagine the dismay that spread among Bob Dylan fans?
Yeah, I think I always get the feeling he quite liked causing dismay amongst his fans. But then the ones that stick with him, they actually appreciate him for that, because he takes them outside of their comfort zone.
Completely.
And himself outside of his comfort zone. So much so that he makes lots of mistakes, but you kind of have to forgive him for the mistakes and the kind of bad stuff. Because in a way that makes possible the good stuff.
Yeah, like his sort of poetic heroes, like Rambo, the flawed romantics.
On that note, let me just round things off as far as this segment is concerned, because, we all could have brought, I'm sure, 15 or 16 songs. What was it, if you can answer this quickly, what was your second, if you had a second choice, what would it have been?
Well, I certainly think that the death of Emmett Till on the most recent bootleg is amazing. And I want to mention, because we haven't really talked about late Dylan, I want to mention... Two relatively late Dylan, Lovesick from Time Out of Mind and Red River Shore.
Unfortunately, you don't have time to explain those.
Bootleg series. But I just think we shouldn't... There's good stuff. Obviously, the early stuff is tends to be where our focus is, you know, up to 75, yeah, up to that watershed. But there is good stuff to
be found.
Oh,
I nearly picked Mississippi from Love and Theft. Yep. It was a toss-up, really, but I fancied some...
And there's so much good stuff on the bootlegs that hasn't been recorded, like Blind Willie McTell,
Tangled Up in Blue, or You're a Big Girl Now, which you've mentioned, one other song that springs to mind that you could conceivably have brought here today.
Sign at the Window was my first choice.
Very good.
It's a melancholy, I guess. Maybe I'm just like an emo Bob Dylan fan. I just love it. It makes
If you'd
me
have brought that,
cry.
You might have won the maximum Dylan cred, because that's from New Morning, isn't it?
Yeah.
To pick a track from New Morning, I think, could have been the slam dunk, but you didn't.
Well, next time. We'll do a more obscure...
Talking of next time, just before you go, give us an idea of what you're up to now. You've been quiet for a couple of years since First Love came out.
Yeah, my next album is out in a month.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. And we're going to start... Yesterday was our first gig back, and we're going to start touring.
How was your first gig back?
It was actually really, really fun. We've got a slightly new lineup, and we just can't wait to start playing again. It's really weird not playing for a year.
And festivals, inevitably, I would imagine.
Well, we're starting with Glastonbury, which always makes us pretty tired for the rest. And we're finishing in September with End of the Road. So, and in the middle of that, I think we're going to Asia and New York.
Now, the other thing I mentioned the first time you walked in here today was that there's ongoing campaigning about stopping libraries closing in which you've been involved, which I think is worth mentioning, seeing as this is The Guardian and we like talking about libraries.
Yes.
Tell me about that and what you did.
There was the National Library Read-In Day, and I went to York Gardens in Battersea, which is a community library. I took part in a read-in there, which is actually... And I saw... Do you know the actor Sam West?
Not personally, but I know of him.
I saw him do this speech, which is now doing the rounds of the internet, which was just fantastic, where he talks about the game SimCity. Do you know the game SimCity? You're the mayor of a city, and you, as you become more prosperous, you build more buildings. If you build a library in SimCity, your citizens become richer. You add to the value of your city. And his quote was, not even in the SimCity universe would a local would a councillor dare to suggest that you shut down a library. It was a really powerful thing to see.
To take this back to Dylan, the first time I actually had a Bob Dylan record in my hand, it was a cassette actually, which I took and listened to, was one borrowed from a public library.
Well,
it was a cassette copy of Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits, Volume 1.
In East Grinstead, where my parents live, you can't actually acquire a CD that isn't from a charity shop unless you go to the library anymore. You have to travel like an hour and a half to find a CD shop, but the library has Bob Dylan CDs.
So on that note, we will say, if you want to make you and the world a better place, once this podcast is finished, go to your library and borrow a Bob Dylan record. Thank you, Stephen and Emmy, for joining us and sharing your love of Bob Dylan. Now we're going to jump deep into the world of Dylanology with James McGrath, a lecturer in cultural studies at Leeds Metropolitan University and a Dylan specialist. I spoke to him earlier on and began with a big question. Why is Dylan's 70th birthday such a big occasion?
Well, I think one thing is that in his 50-year career so far, there have been so many changes. He's always been ready to do something, to see it through, and then to move on. By the time he does move on, what he was doing last is usually reaching a new generation of influencees. And, of course, in popular music, and especially perhaps in the 60s, things could turn around quite rapidly in that way.
So, it's the fact that he seems to, even now, he seems to move at a higher speed than most other artists, essentially.
Yes. And I think something... I think another big reason to celebrate Dylan turning 70 is that in popular culture, perhaps especially with popular music, young death tends to be glamorised. And while Dylan has survived so much, some of his personal difficulties have been quite high profile in 66, for example, with the motorcycle accident. Also in 1997, when he had the heart infection and was hospitalised, I think that moment, I remember that morning, the front pages of the British broadsheets were reporting the news as if he would have died by the time we read this, but happily he survived. What did happen that day was, I think, people really realised just how important Dylan has been.
That's very interesting, isn't it, in the sense that in nearly dying, we were reminded of what a privilege it was to have him around, and then that explains why, sort of, from time out of mind, the 97 album onwards... his sort of his fame and the level at which he's held in terms of regard has been a sort of renewed high. That's fair to say, isn't it?
I would agree with that, yes. It has sustained itself. You know, it was nearly 15 years ago that we're talking about, so...
The other thing, I mean, I wrote this in The Guardian the other week that I find very interesting and brilliant about him is that rock music, particularly in the hands of people of Dylan's generation, tends to be about denying the ageing process. If you look at Mick Jagger, for example, who's still shaking his bum and trying to convince us that it's 1972 forever. And there's Dylan, who really has built age and experience and, let's be honest, mortality into every note that he sings, which is amazing, really. I mean, old blues guys do it, but of sort of white rock performers, him and Neil Young are arguably the only one.
I think you're right, yes. With Dylan, he tends to change his set list fairly frequently. But also, when you go and see him live, you often overhear people sort of complaining that it doesn't sound like the recordings. But why should they? You know, we have the recordings already. And I think people go to not just to see Dylan, but to hear him. But something about seeing him live as well as seeing him live, you know, seeing him do what he's most famous for, including being unpredictable, you know.
You teach bits of Bob Dylan in the course of your academic work. Can you just tell us what in terms of sort of educating your students, what bits of Bob Dylan you actually teach?
I've sometimes used his lyrics to make the point to English literature students that it doesn't matter if a text doesn't provide you with any easy answer. I mean, one of my favourite lines from Dylan is When the Night Comes Falling from the Sky, and he sings, I can't provide for you no easy answers, who are you that I should have to lie? So I think that Dylan, one of the great things about him is he's never underestimated the intelligence and the imagination of an audience of millions. You know, his songs sort of start us thinking, but then it's up to us. Those songs sort of deserve and reward and demand quite close attention.
I mean, he's had a 50-year career. You're teaching people, what, in their early 20s? Are they sort of up for learning about him, immersing themselves in Dylan's music as much as maybe the likes of you and I were when we were in our early 20s?
There are some students who seem very, very enthralled by Dylan already. But what I've also noticed, because I also teach media studies, and I've sometimes shown clips from Dylan in 1966, and those, you know, on a course that, or on a module that involves various clips of live performance and so on, it's those clips of Dylan in that period that really seem to captivate people. And I think that has to do with... apart from anything else, how ill he looked. You know, Joan Baez later said that she was really, really worried that he just wasn't going to live much longer. And I think it's strange how there's something about that image of someone under so much pressure that seems to really draw people in. You know, those images from 66 have been distributed a lot more in the last 10, 15 years than they were in the 60s, perhaps.
It's like a deathly charisma.
Yes.
Let me ask you one question, which we've asked everyone today.
Okay.
It's a ridiculous question, but if you can pick one Bob Dylan song to take to your grave, what would it be?
It would probably be If You See Her, Say Hello.
From Blood on the Tracks. And that's nearly it for this week. Thanks to Emmy the Great, Stephen Moss and James McGrath for taking part, and to you for all your tweets and retweets over the last week. To finish the programme this week, we'll leave you with a reading from a new audiobook version of Michael Gray's Bob Dylan Encyclopedia. You can find out more about it and leave comments on this week's programme on our blog at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. The programme was produced by Scott Corley, and Alexis and Rosie will be back next week. I'm John Harris. Thanks for listening. Well, I see you got your brand new leopard skin pillbox hair. Yes, I see you got your brand new leopard skin pillbox hair. Well, you must tell me, baby, how your head feels under something like that. Under your brand new leopard skin pillbox hair. The Blonde on Blonde song Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat is neatly revealing about the way that even in his hippest, most radical and risky period, Dylan stood upon the bedrock of the blues. In one way, this song is utterly Dylan-esque,
and wholly redolent of that Warhol factory New York City milieu. So 1960s, so chic and fey, so knowing and druggy and poised. And engaging for its weird mix of energy and high comedy with an elaborate and ostentatious stance of ennui. Yet, at the same time, it is coach-built upon the chassis of a Lightnin' Hopkins song from 1949, His Automobile Blues. It is not just a melodic parallel. Hopkins begins, I saw you riding round, you was riding in your brand new automobile. Yes, I saw you riding round, you was riding round in your brand new automobile. Yes, you were sitting there happy with your handsome driver at the wheel in your brand new automobile. And sings that extra last line. His voice takes on that familiar downward curve, ending on that Dylan-esque, long, sliding beel that is a slippery mixture of a knowing sneer and some malicious envy. Dylan makes sly acknowledgement of his source in the last verse of his own song, with the in-joke admonition that you forgot to close the garage door.
Well, I see you got a new boyfriend. No, I've never seen him before.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.